Up next, the Tuesday State Department press briefing with State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. Among other things, she dealt with some recent comments by one of her subordinates threatening a peremptory strike on Russia over allegations of violations of the INF Treaty. This is the Tuesday, October 2nd press briefing with Heather Nauert from the State Department in its entirety.
Hi, everybody. How are you today? Cordy, welcome to the front row. Nice to see you all. I'd like to start out with a couple announcements this afternoon. The first is about the earthquake and the tsunami that took place in Indonesia. On September the 28th, an earthquake and tsunami struck central Sulawesi, Indonesia, leaving more than 1,200 people dead, many injured, and it displaced thousands. Our thoughts and prayers go out to those who've been affected by the natural disasters. Our mission in Indonesia immediately reached out to the government of Indonesia to offer assistance. We have provided an initial tranche of funding and deployed USAID disaster experts to conduct damage assessments, identify priority needs, and coordinate U.S. response efforts with the government of Indonesia. We're working with USAID and our counterparts at other government agencies to determine what additional help the United States government can provide. Several U.S. citizens have been safely evacuated. There have been no reports of U.S. citizens who've been killed or injured. Our mission in Indonesia is ready to provide all possible consular assistance to affected U.S. citizens. We urge U.S. citizens in the affected areas who are safe to contact their loved ones directly and update their social media status. If you are in the affected area and need immediate emergency services, please contact local authorities. The United States and Indonesia are strategic partners and friends, and we stand together with the people of Indonesia at this challenging time. I can also share with you that our president, President Trump, spoke with the Indonesian president earlier today to express our condolences on behalf of the U.S. government. The White House will provide a readout of that phone call. Next, I would like to thank the Senate Foreign Relations Committee again for continuing to meet with our well-qualified nominees and move them a little closer to taking up their posts on the field. Right now, we have more than 60 nominations that are awaiting confirmation. The majority of those nominees are Foreign Service officers who bring instrumental skills and decades-long experience to critical posts around the globe, places like Bangladesh, Kenya, Mozambique, Yemen, Uzbekistan, and many others. Missions critical to advancing our U.S. leadership and our foreign policy priorities. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee agrees that these are good, solid candidates. And as I've been saying, we still have too many vacancies here at the State Department, from ambassadors to our folks serving at the assistant secretary level, also at the undersecretary level. Today, once again, we call on the Senate to act so that these candidates can take their place alongside the finest diplomats in the world. While we're talking about those confirmations, I would then like to announce that we have a new undersecretary who started here at the State Department. And I want to extend a warm welcome to Eric Euland, who started this week as the director of U.S. Foreign Assistance Resources. He comes to the department from the Millennium Challenge Corporation and was previously the staff director for the Senate Budget Committee. Look forward to seeing him around the building. Last thing I'd like to announce is that the secretary will be traveling later this week to four countries. He's headed to Asia. Secretary Pompeo will travel to Japan, North Korea, the Republic of Korea, and China from October 6th to the 8th. In Tokyo, October 6th and 7th, the secretary will meet with Prime Minister Abe and Foreign Minister Kono. In Pyongyang, on October the 7th, the secretary will meet with Chairman Kim. In Seoul, on October 7th and 8th, the secretary will meet with President Moon and Foreign Minister Kang. In Beijing, on October the 8th, the secretary will meet with his Chinese counterparts to discuss bilateral, regional, and global issues. With that, I'd be happy to take your questions. So we've got a lot going on today. Matt, you want to start?
I wasn't expecting that trip announcement, so I'll defer to someone else.
Okay. Courtney, I'll start with you.
U.S. Ambassador to NATO Kay Bailey Hutchison mentioned today to reporters that Russia continues to violate the INF Treaty and that while the U.S. would prefer a diplomatic solution, it would be pursuing a potential capability to take out a missile that could hit any of our countries, she said. Is this a change in policy? What does that mean exactly?
Well, we have said for quite some time that Russia has not been in compliance with the INF Treaty. We've been saying this for 4 years now. Russia has not taken any steps to return to compliance. Instead, they've just levied specious accusations about U.S. compliance. And yes, we do believe that we are in compliance with the INF Treaty. I think what Ambassador Hutchison was talking about was improving our overall defense and deterrence posture. The current situation where Russia is just blatantly violating our central tenet of the INF Treaty is untenable. Our goal is Russian compliance. We go back and say that time and time again, that Russian compliance is what we are seeking. We've taken diplomatic, we've taken military, research and development, and also economic measures to increase the costs on Russia and ensure the security of the United States and our allies. If Russia chooses not to return into compliance with its treaty obligations. So these are a series of ongoing conversations that are being had right now. The United States is committed to upholding its arms control obligations and expects Russia to do the very same thing. Ambassador Hutchison said our goal is Russian compliance, and we're in close consultation with our allies on this issue. Okay. Pardon me? Oh, thank you. Apparently, Ambassador Hutchison just tweeted about it, so I'd encourage you to take a look at her tweet for any further questions. Okay.
Yes.
Hi.
You're referring us to a tweet for further questions?
Well, sometimes, yes, because Ambassador Hutchison characters. Spoke to that herself in her tweet. Go right ahead.
Yeah, thank you. On the trip you just announced, so the Secretary will meet with Chairman Kim. Can you tell us who else he will be meeting, if you know that already? And also, what do you concretely expect from this trip to move on? There has been a bit of stall on the negotiations. Now, what are the steps you expect from North Korea? And the last thing
Just pause you right there, because I wouldn't agree with your characterization that there has been a stall. I would say that there has not been. As you know, the Secretary met with the Foreign Minister last week.
I was saying before that,
in
because
North Korea,
the President canceled last week, saying there wasn't
I see. Okay.
Progress.
We continue to have these conversations. Yeah. And I think it shows forward progress and momentum that the Secretary is making his fourth trip back in less than a year. The first, of course, was as CIA director. This will be his third as Secretary of State. And that shows the President's commitment to the agreement that he and Chairman Kim came to at the Singapore summit. The Secretary going on for follow-on conversations. As we often say, the conversations continue. Of course, we have quite a ways to go, but we look forward to the next steps in this conversation.
Which steps?
Next steps in continuing the conversation. Yeah.
Okay.
And a lot of these things, as you well know, are not things that we're going to discuss publicly. These are private diplomatic conversations as we work toward our goal of full denuclearization of North Korea.
And does the Secretary still stick to his date of January 2021, since the President said after that it wasn't a good idea to have timelines? And
So I would encourage you to go back and look at the transcript. The Secretary said he was hopeful that that could happen, recognizing that there is still a long way to go. The President said, and the Secretary,
the denuclearization to be completed by.
And the Secretary and the President said, we're not going to set arbitrary deadlines in the interim. We're hopeful. We're working toward that goal. Everyone recognizes that we have a way to go, ways to go, and a lot of work that is left to be done. I'm not going to get ahead of the Secretary's meetings that he'll have in Pyongyang, but I know he looks forward to continuing the conversation.
Is it still the administration's position that you are not willing to consider any easing of sanctions until full denuclearization has been verified, but that you are willing to consider something short of, to do things, confidence-building steps that are short of sanctions, along the lines of what the Secretary himself talked about when he was in Tokyo after the last time he went?
I don't have his remarks in front of me from Tokyo at that time, but among the things that the Secretary discussed were security assurances, things of that nature. So the United States has not changed its policy. Nothing has changed in that regard over the past few months.
You're willing to do that short of you're still willing to take steps that are short of sanctions.
I'm not going to characterize it that way. Sanctions remain in full effect, not just the United States sanctions, UN Security Council resolutions, and the other countries that fully backed those Security Council resolutions. All of that remains in effect. We are not easing the pressure in that regard at all.
Any consideration of a peace declaration of any type, Heather?
We are not. Nothing has changed with regard to our policy. We've discussed that a lot of times before.
So the fact that the Secretary is going, should we
take that to mean that North Korea has done something or shown something in particular to make him feel that this is going to be productive?
Well, I haven't been privy to all the letters and the communications that have gone back and forth. But obviously, these conversations are going in the right direction. And we feel confident enough to hop on a plane to head there to continue the conversations.
And China, no, I'm not changing the subject, just based on this trip. Are these going to be high-level meetings? I mean, is the Secretary satisfied that the Chinese are going to produce the people in the meeting that he wants to meet with, and they're not? I mean, this is going to be, when you say his counterparts, mm-hmm. or his counterpart, this is going to be foreign minister level and high-level meetings, right? They're not just producing junior ministers.
I think when the Secretary goes, there's the expectation that he meets with someone who's his appropriate counterpart. I don't have anything beyond what I provided you just now. Okay? Hi.
Hi.
Okay, hold on. I'll come back to you, Jen.
So in China, is the Secretary attending the U.S.-China diplomatic and security dialogue? Is that the purpose of the travel?
The trip is, as far as I understand, to have conversations about North Korea and other issues of bilateral concern. I don't have anything beyond that right now. This is something that we just got confirmation on, so I'm going to hesitate to comment any more on beyond what I have right here.
So is the DSD still happening? Is the diplomatic?
We've never confirmed anything. DOD's never confirmed anything. If I have any additional trips or any information about China travel, I'll bring it to you as soon as I can.
Okay? Heather, the statement of the president recently, how he was in love with Kim Jong-un, is that help or hinder Mr. Pompeo's trip? One would have thought that it reduces pressure on Mr. Kim to take some of the steps that Mr. Pompeo wants him to do?
I think if our leaders have relatively friendly relations, that's a good thing, that can only help us to achieve our final goal.
But the president has also said a timeline doesn't matter. I mean, he keeps saying things which makes it sound as if the pressure's being eased off of the...
I don't think so. I mean, if you look at our policies have not changed one bit. We got behind the maximum pressure campaign. The United States government still stands firmly behind the sanctions put in place. The world stands behind those sanctions that have put in place. We've not eased that one bit. In fact, every chance we have the opportunity to discuss, whether it's with China or Russia or any other country around the world, we're talking about keeping the sanctions in place and not easing those sanctions on North Korea fully verified denuclearization.
That isn't what the Chinese and the Russians said in the Security Council last week, is it?
They are standing by the sanctions. Now, we do always say they can do more. They can do more, but they stand by those sanctions. Okay? Hi, Janet. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Heather. As you know, that the North Korean Foreign Minister Lee Hyung-ho said last week at the UN, he said that the United States must first have corresponding measures mm-hmm. before North Korea, denuclearizations. What is your position of this, and what is the corresponding measures of North Korea?
Could you repeat the last part? I'm sorry, say the last part again.
Corresponding measures of North Korea. So what kind of that? And do you have anything hold secretary when
I can tell you our policy has not changed. Our policy has not changed. Things stand firmly in place, such as the sanctions remain in place. We continue to coordinate very closely, as we will on this upcoming trip, with our South Korean and also our Japanese counterparts, and we'll continue to move ahead and continue with the conversation.
The declaration of the end of the war that mm-hmm. the President Moon pressured to United States, are you agree with that?
We are closely coordinating with the Japanese and the South Koreans, and we look forward to having meetings with them when we go on this next trip. Okay? Okay. Hold on. Saeed, go right ahead.
Wait, hold on. Still on North Korea.
I can come back to you, Matt. Hold on. Let's go to Saeed.
I thought we wanted to stay with North Korea.
It's okay. Right? We'll come back to it then. Saeed, go right ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. I wanted to ask you about Israeli action in Gaza. I mean, in the last few days, they have turned Gaza into a free fire zone. They killed 10 Palestinians, including 4 children. Today alone, 63 people were injured. Yesterday, the same thing. Are you okay with that? Are you not upset? Are you not concerned that the civilians are being basically just shot out at will by the Israeli army?
We've addressed this before when these types of things have happened. And I'll go back to saying what I've always said, and that is we are always concerned about credible reports of excessive use of force. I imagine that the Israeli government will be taking a look at this. We always look forward to governments taking a look at their own actions. Let's remember, in large part, what has gotten the Israelis and Palestinians to this point, and that is Hamas. And Hamas bears the ultimate responsibility for the misery of the people living in Gaza and in some of the surrounding areas. Hamas is reckless when it encourages people to show up, when it encourages people to fight, when it encourages young people to try to engage in violence. That is a very dangerous situation. There was an extremely tense situation, you recall, back in the spring, and say, don't take your children to the area, leave your children at home. But remember, Hamas is the one that bears ultimate responsibility for
this. These kids get shot at about, 400-300 meters away. I mean, they are in their own enclosed area. I mean, they're not basically jumping over the fence. They're not going to the Israeli side and so on. They are, in their open prison territory.
I'm not going to I'm not going to characterize everything as being far or close, Saeed. I don't think that's a fair assessment of the situation, but I think I just laid it out that we're always concerned with the credible use of force. And then we go back to saying that Israel does have a right to defend itself. That's U.S. policy, and that hasn't changed
either. I wonder if you would address the Khan al-Ahmar village, the Bedouin village, because, all your allies have objected to it. Do you object to the demolition of this Palestinian Bedouin village in Khan al-Ahmar?
Yeah, my latest understanding is what it was not too terribly long ago when you had asked me this very same question. The impending evacuation of the Bedouin residents in that village follows a lengthy legal process. I believe that's gone on for 8 years or so. I just have to refer you back to the government of Israel on that one. Lori, go right ahead.
The UN, which monitored the elections in the Kurdistan region, has described them as successful. Is that a position you'd agree with?
That the elections in the Kurdistan region?
Yeah, that were just
that was just a question. Yeah, okay. We congratulate the people of Iraq from the Kurdistan region for participating in the election on the 30th of September. Voting is obviously a critical part of any democratic society. We look forward to the final certification of the results of that vote. My understanding is that it has not been certified just yet, so we will certainly keep a close eye on that, and we would encourage the quick formation of the new Kurdish government. So and while you're standing there, let me just congratulate your friend behind you. Yes, we all heard you at the press conference asking the president questions. Lori, I'm sorry you weren't there to ask those questions yourself. But as I heard you I was sitting in the back of the room, I said, there he is, there's our guy, meaning our friend here from the press briefing room asking a question. And I also saw, was it your editorial in the Wall Street Journal today?
It was an imposter's editorial.
Oh, it was, okay. It was Majid's editorial. Yeah. So nicely done. Just wanted to say that. Lori, go ahead, you had another question. I'll come right back to you. Lori, did you have another question?
Well, I have two more questions briefly. On Friday, the Russian foreign minister strongly criticized your position on Iran, saying there's no proof that it backed terrorism and you can't keep Iran in a cage within its borders. What is your response to that?
I think I would go to something that the French just announced today. And there's probably no one who has felt terrorism stemming from Iran, perhaps more than, the Syrians, that has felt it more than some Europeans. As we just learned today that the French government announced that it had seized assets from Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security Services and the assets of two Iranian officials, this was after there was a disruption in plans to bomb a political rally near Paris just this June. So we have seen that as Americans, our Marine barracks bombings back in 1983. We've seen those types of attacks that Iran has been solely responsible for. We've seen this type of thing that I just mentioned, the news coming out of France today. We've seen what Iran has done in Syria. We've seen what Iran has done in other countries. We see Iran's devastation that it causes around the world as the world's top sponsor of terrorism. So whatever the Russians said about that, we're not buying it.
Okay, and final question somewhat related to that. The Pentagon today, they suggested that the closure of the consulate in Basra, which you announced, hasn't yet begun. Could you give us an update on that?
Sure. So we ordered, the secretary made the decision late last week to announce ordered departure of our diplomats who are serving in Basra in southern Iraq. In terms of the timing of that and all the details of our colleagues' movement, I'm not going to get into that for obvious reasons, but just I can tell you that, you know, the secretary obviously made that decision, and it's not a decision that one would make or take that decision lightly. It's something that a lot of thought and planning and preparation goes into that. Okay. Go right ahead.
Hold on one sec. Today, Iraqi parliament elected for presidency, and that's mean mm-hmm. Iran has more influence than you over there. And they tried divided the Kurds, and before State Department has statement and support strong and unique Iraqi Kurdistan mm-hmm. in federal and democratic of Iraq.
So,
any comments about that?
Yeah, we just saw this announcement maybe within the last hour or so. So I don't have any comment on that specific selection. I can tell you we respect Iraq's democratic process. As you well know, we have a very strong relationship with the government, and we believe the people of Iraq. That relationship is firm, it is friendly, and we are committed to the country of Iraq and also Iraq's sovereignty. And that's something important that this administration discusses, the importance of sovereignty, and certainly Iraqis can understand that and appreciate that and respect that as well. We don't support any particular party or any particular candidate, but we support a fair and transparent process. Okay. Go right ahead. Yeah.
There are some reports of fraud in the province of Sulaymaniyah, and two major opposition parties have rejected the outcome of the election. Mm-hmm. Have you heard those complaints?
I have not heard that complaint, but I think, as I just mentioned a moment ago, that the results would have to be certified, so I'll just hold off comment until that takes place. Cindy, go right ahead.
Thanks. I know the Pakistani foreign minister may still be here in the building. Are there any updates on attempts to reset the relationship? And he hinted on Fox News that there might be a compromise in the fate of the Pakistani doctor who helped the U.S. find Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, I think they've been saying that for quite some time, that there could be some movement on that. We have yet to see that. I can confirm to you that the secretary did meet with his counterpart at the State Department today. Not sure exactly when that was. It was sometime this afternoon. I don't have a readout of that meeting just yet. If I have one to bring for you, provide to you, I certainly will. But we had a good trip when the secretary went to Pakistan and had good, fruitful meetings with the Pakistani government.
Get a follow-up on that?
Okay. Hold on one second. Let me go to Verda.
Abby, I just wanted to follow up. I know that there have been some comments out of the State Department on this, but is there any reason for concern for same-sex partners who currently hold U.S. visas working at the U.N. That they may no longer be able to stay in the U.S.?
Short answer, no. We just did a background briefing for reporters about less than 2 hours ago. I haven't had a chance to take a look at that transcript. I wasn't on that call, so I don't want to get too into the details because our technical experts, who are the experts on visas and all that, were involved in that call. So I just have to refer you back to that, and if you have any additional questions, I'd be happy to try to get an answer for you.
This seems to have ignited a fair amount of outrage, which the people on the call tried to tamp down and say was basically misinformed outrage. But just look at the headlines of one of the advocacy groups
Are you saying that you believe all the headlines that you read?
Heather, I believe everything I read. Absolutely.
I know you do not believe the headlines that you
read.
But
it said UN same sex.
Hold on a second. The reporters, you're all the ones who are telling me that you don't write your own headlines, that there are other people who do it, and you grumble as much as anyone, if not more than anyone else in Washington, about those headline writers who will often misinterpret stories that you yourselves have written. So I just wanted to highlight that.
That is neither here nor there, but I was joking when I said I believe everything I read. But I just want you to say, I mean, some of this stuff is like same-sex people were going to be ripped from their families, and if they don't get married, they're going to be deported. The people on the call said that was not correct, that there would be exceptions made for people who were in tenuous circumstances, but they were all on background. No one was willing to put their name to it. So can you say podium?
That's in keeping with the State Department policy.
Well, I just want
in terms
from
of putting people on background calls, and that is something that we regularly do, so that our rank and file colleagues and technical experts can have the freedom to express and explain policy without worrying about having reporters pound them every single minute.
I'm not looking for a defense of background calls. Yeah. I'm wondering if you are prepared to say on the record that what they said on background, which was that this won't that people are not going to be ripped, that families aren't going to be torn asunder. And the other thing that they said was that this is actually a way for the administration to promote marriage equality. And while it may be, it's an awfully odd way to do that.
That is your opinion, that it's an odd way to do that. I'm going to have to refer to the background call at this point. I'm sorry, it may be frustrating for you. I haven't had a chance to even review that transcript, so I'm sure you can appreciate that I want to bring you the most accurate information. I want to have a chance to review what my colleagues, the technical experts, have said about this. If you need something from me on the record, let me know. I'd be happy to provide it to you, okay?
On that call, there were a number of questions that just weren't answered, and okay. One of them is...
Again, I was not on that call, but if you want to send me some of the questions and what you're interested in, I'd be happy to try to get you on the record answers to those things.
Okay, so one of the questions that wasn't answered was the special envoy position for LGBTI mm-hmm. rights. Is that going to be filled?
I don't have any information for you on that today. Some of those would be White House nominations, and I just don't have any color on that today. Right. Okay? Mm-hmm. Rich, go right ahead.
Just very briefly on Africa. The First Lady is there, and before going, she praised the work that USAID is doing. Mm-hmm. Of course, the administration has proposed very deep cuts to USAID's budget. Are there any concerns over mixed messages in that?
I don't think so at all. In fact, I know USAID Administrator Mark Green is proud and pleased to assist the First Lady with her trip over there. We've been watching from afar as we see the pictures of her with children and our colleagues on the ground who are doing such good work. So the U.S. government obviously has to take a look at where it's spending its resources and the best use of taxpayer dollars. The decisions that the government makes are not always decisions that individuals will always agree with, but we decide to make those decisions based on where we think that our taxpayer dollars can be best used. But the continent of Africa is one that's extremely important to this administration, to the U.S. government, and I think that is evident in the fact that the First Lady is making her first solo foreign trip to the African continent. Okay. Hold on. Sir, how are you?
I'm fine. I was going to ask, thank you, Heather, for you mentioned earlier about Russia and its violation of the INF Treaty. The Russian Defense Minister recently announced that. Get that up.
Go ahead. Sorry, I dropped something here.
Numerous S-300 surface-to-air missiles have been sent to Syria mm-hmm. right now. The administration's reaction to this.
I saw that report. I cannot confirm that that is accurate. I hope that they did not. That would be a serious escalation in concerns and issues going on in Syria. But I just can't confirm it, so I don't have anything more for you on that right now.
Can you also Syria?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it would be a sort of serious escalation or a serious escalation?
It would be an escalation.
Okay. And then the other thing on Syria is that Secretary Mattis at a press conference in Paris today said that the number of diplomats posted in Syria has doubled. I know you don't want to talk about your staffing policies and in specifics, but is it correct that it's doubled? And even if that's not exactly accurate, are you in the process of boosting the number of people that you're putting, civilians, diplomats?
Well, as you correctly predicted, we won't discuss the size or staffing of our posture, especially in a place like Syria, Matt, for obvious security concerns. But as you well know, we do have civilians who serve in Iraq. They're incredibly brave, in Iraq, but in Syria as well, who are incredibly brave and do some incredible work on the part of the American people to help support Syrians. We are constantly looking for ways to enhance our effectiveness of our stabilization efforts in Syria. We consider that to be critical to the work that we do and the work in defeating ISIS. But in terms of the size of the footprint or the posture or whether we're doubling or tripling or any of that, we just won't get into that.
Well, what exactly are these people doing or will they do? What do they do? When they get up in the morning,
the premise
after
of
they
your question is that we will be changing the number of people there. I can tell you what our people have been doing.
Or are doing right now.
I haven't checked to find out exactly what some of my colleagues are doing today. But in general, they have been involved in stabilization efforts. They've been involved in helping to find local Iraqi groups and other groups that have participated, and Syrian groups that have participated in removing rubble, in helping to get electricity back on in certain towns that have lost electricity. Clean water, the rebuilding of schools is something that they have been involved with. Providing humanitarian aid is a big one that our folks are involved with. But what exactly they're doing today,
well, no,
on the 2nd of October,
minute.
That answer, I can't give you that answer.
I'm not looking for a minute-by-minute update. But this is all stuff that you guys had been funding and you're no longer funding. So they are working projects that other countries like the Saudis and the Emiratis are funding.
I'll double check. I'll find out the latest on what they're doing and see if I can bring that to you. Okay. Okay. And then we're gonna have to wrap it up pretty soon. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Thank you. The Chinese Foreign Ministry yesterday said the United States has recently expressed its intention to postpone the U.S.-China diplomatic and security dialogue. So my question is, has the United States requested to cancel that meeting, that dialogue?
I think I just addressed that, and that is we're going to Beijing. We'll be there in just a few days. I'm not going to get ahead of the Secretary's meetings, and I can just tell you we look forward to heading to Beijing.
Is it fair to say that the U.S.-China diplomatic relation hasn't been infected by the recent, you know, trade dispute and other tensions?
Look, I think in any relationship, you have your high points, you have your medium points, and in some countries, you have your low points. And I'm not going to characterize our relationship with China in any one of those three ways, but relationships can ebb and flow over time. So we have certainly a lot to talk about with the government of China and look forward to that trip. Let me just move on to Nick, all the way in the back there. Hey, Nick.
Thanks. I do want to go back to North Korea. Go back to Michelle's question. Last time, obviously, the secretary was supposed to go. You canceled his trip last minute. What's changed now? Yesterday, KCNA, North Korean media, said the U.S. was spouting rubbish by forcing North Korea to declare its inventory, dismantle Yongbyon in exchange for declaration of the end of the war. How is that kind of rhetoric helpful, and how is that different from the letter that caused you to cancel your last trip? And is that your policy, by the way? Are you going to declare the end of the war in exchange for declaration
of
inventory?
Your last question, I think I answered that already. In terms of North Korea's policy, that is something that North Korea had agreed to, that Chairman Kim had agreed to with the president, and that is denuclearization. And that is a policy that we are working toward. Nothing has changed in that regard. Other countries sometimes will say things that are more colorful than the United States will, and that's just fine too. We have a meeting scheduled. We're looking forward to that and pushing ahead.
Really?
Okay.
More
colorful
than the rhetoric from North Korea.
Pardon me?
Rhetoric from North Korea yesterday compared to the rhetoric that was in that letter that caused you to cancel the last.
I'm not going to get into what was in that letter between Chairman Kim and also the President of the United States, so I can't get into that, okay? I don't have to wrap it up. Michelle, go right ahead.
News reports coming from Turkey said that Pastor Bronson will be maybe released in mid-October. Do you have any information?
I cannot confirm that. We certainly would like Pastor Bronson home right away. It's long overdue. Pastor Brunson has a hearing, I believe it's October the 12th. We last saw him, I believe it was about a week and a half ago or so, where we provided consular access to Pastor Brunson, and we'll continue to maintain close contact with the Turkish government. But anything beyond that, I'd have to refer you to his lawyer for the latest on his case.
Heather, just back on North Korea for 2 seconds. It still is the administration's position that that North Korea is basically a gulag state, that Kim Jong-un presides over a government that jails thousands and thousands of political prisoners, jails people for their religious beliefs, including Americans, routinely violates people's human rights. That is correct.
You've seen our human rights report.
Exactly.
Our human rights report is very clear about the concerns that we have, not just about North Korea, but many countries, frankly, around the world, and countries that can do a lot better.
So
our priority in North Korea, though, right now, is denuclearization.
Right. Oh.
And that is something that we are focused on.
Human rights aren't a priority anymore?
Human rights, Matt, we can go around again and again and again about this. Human rights is always important.
Well, I just wanna,
whether we're talking about North Korea, whether we're talking about many other countries around the world, we raise those issues, and those are important issues, and we're not afraid to raise those issues.
So Secretary Pompeo,
however,
will
I will tell you that we are working on denuclearization, and that is our focus right now.
So Secretary Pompeo, during his denuclearization talks, will raise human rights with Kim Jong-un.
I'm not going to get into their private diplomatic conversations,
but What does it say to you then, if you still believe that this regime is a horrible violator of human rights, kills people wantonly, jails them for their religious beliefs and political beliefs, what does it say to you that the president of the country, this country,
on Wednesday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin hosted a forum in Moscow on energy titled the Russian Energy Week International Forum. It's the second of its kind, scheduled to be held through Saturday, to connect experts and representatives of the world's leading energy companies to discuss energy solutions.
Dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, I am happy to welcome all the participants and guests to the Russian Energy Week. This time, the forum has brought together the record number of professionals, all those interested in the energy sector, 9,500 people. So they came here so that in an open, reliable and trusting discussion to discuss the global energy agenda. It is well known that Russia is one of the major stakeholders of the Russian energy market. We take the leading positions in producing and exporting oil and gas. We are among the leaders of electric energy production and production of coal. It is very important for us to be highly responsive to the trends of global energy so that efficiently utilize our competitive advantages and together with other countries to form the joint energy space and joint energy future. We believe that ensuring the progress of world energy sector, the reliable energy security of our whole planet, is only possible through global partnership, working according to joint same rules, the same for all, and of course, transparent, constructive dialogue of all the participants of the market without any political undercurrents, on the basis of pragmatism, understanding of solidarity, and solidarity reliability of mutual interests. The balance of supply and demand in the oil market achieved thanks to the agreement with OPEC has proven that our approach was right. Russia is going to further foster the dialogue between oil-producing countries to ensure stability of the oil markets, to create sustainable conditions for the development of the sector and ensuring long-term investments. I'd like to point out, in the near future, demand for oil is going to grow mostly thanks to the consumers in the Asian Pacific region, although the same trends are to be observed in Europe and in North America. Reliable partner-like approach of Russia is crystal clear. Russia fulfills it both at the gas market, where it demonstrates an example of reliability and predictability, and on other markets too. Our advantage is not only the major stocks of natural gas, but also the presence of well-developed delivery infrastructure, as well as a pipeline infrastructure that ensures low-cost and sustainable tons of net gas at the market. Apart from that, the levels of LNG trade is also growing. In the recent 10 years, it has almost doubled. Russia is an active participant of the LNG market. We put into operation new producing and processing capacities. We carry out strategic plans of development of transportation infrastructure, among other things, improve the Northern Sea route and create icebreaker fleet that will allow for all year round navigation, including the gas carriers within the spaces of Russian Arctic. Another important track of global energy that also is showing positive trends is coal industry. 10 years ago, very few believed that it is a promising energy resource. However, today we see the demand for coal growing, especially in the countries of APR. For Russia, it is important to get a foothold and increase its capacities at this dynamic market. We improve our capacity, including those of the infrastructure, the Baikal system, the Trans-Siberian Railroad. We improve the capacity of the seaports. We ensure efficiency and security of production. We give extra attention to eco-friendliness of technologies, transportation of coal and its consumption, especially in electricity production. We are going to improve the heat generation in Russia to introduce digitalization to the energy network. In the nearest 20 years, the world is likely to see the robust demand for energy. The experts believe that by the year 2040, the consumption of electricity power is going to double, while the demand for primary sources of energy, that is oil, coal, and gas, and other important sources, will be higher by 30%. The same trends are to be observed in exports and in the technology of the energy production. Another important point is maintaining leading positions in such a high-tech sector as nuclear energy. Today, Russia is actively constructing 25 nuclear power plants in 12 countries of the world. All in all, we are planning to build 36 of those. We are going to increase the number of requests in electricity and energy while maintaining the highest possible standards in security and industry. Another important goal is the development of renewable energy sources, especially in the hard-to-access and remote regions of our country, such as East Siberia and the Russian Far East. For our vast country, the largest in the world, with its diverse natural and climatic conditions, we have enormous opportunities and potential for development. Summing up, I'd like to say the following thing. Sustainable, progressive development of energy is the key condition for dynamic growth of global economy, improvement of the quality of life of our people, improvement of welfare of all the people on our planet. Russia is open for cooperation in the field of energy. That is for the benefit of the global energy security, for the benefit of the future generations. And of course, we hope for the active dialogue on all these topics and for cooperation. Thank you very much for attention.
President Putin, thank you very much. While you were making your way here, I informed everyone in the room that you were meeting with the OPEC Secretary General. I'm not sure if that was a secret or not, but it's no longer a secret. I want to start with the price of oil and the oil market. The question everyone wanted to know from you and from the OPEC Secretary General in Saudi Arabia last year was, at this gathering, was how long you were prepared to maintain the cuts in production. Well, a lot has changed over the last year. The question now is how much more oil is Russia prepared to add to the market? If you think about this time last year and now, the price of oil, a barrel of oil, is more than 50% what it was last year, from about $55 a barrel to $85 a barrel today. A lot of people would argue that shows the success of Russia's partnership with OPEC. That said, there is one other head of state, President Trump, who says that the price of oil is too high. Is Russia going to pump more oil to lower prices?
So, in the first part, you meant whether Russia is ready to maintain the volumes of production.
Was how long is Russia prepared to maintain cuts? Now the question is, how much oil is Russia going to give to the market?
As for the reduction of production and keeping it quite low, well, you see that this is just a tool. This is not our goal. Our goal is to balance the market. When we, together with our colleagues and friends from OPEC, agreed that we cut the production. This is what we were talking about. We talked about cutting excessive stocks. We're talking about balancing the market, because this is not about incomes of oil companies. This is about the situation in this industry. It is about creating tools for investment projects. This is what we talked about. Apart from that, if market is not balanced, there is a situation which leads to reduced investment, and as a result, finally, this will create a deficit at the market, and the prices will jump up. Our position is very responsible. We were talking about balancing the market, and we managed to reach this goal together with our colleagues from OPEC. We have really met with OPEC Secretary General right now, and we talked about our cooperation, and probably for the first time in history, all the participants of such agreements came up with their obligations 100%. They totally complied with their obligations. For example, take Russia. Our obligation was to cut the production by 300,000 of barrels, and we did so. So the market is balanced right now. Oil price is growing, but this is not the result of our activity, but the result of circumstances that we created, the result of expectations and decisions about Iran, which were absolutely illicit and malicious for global economy. I'm also talking about developments in Northern Africa related to some circumstances there, like civil war and so on and so forth. I'm talking about situation in Venezuela, about the restrictions that were introduced there. President Trump, as you said, thinks that this price is too high. Well, probably to some end he's right, but we are absolutely okay with it. $65, $70, $75 per barrel is okay in order to ensure efficient operation of energy companies and ensure investment process. But let's be frank, such oil price is actually to some part result of activities of current U.S. administration. I'm talking about sanctions against Iran, about political problems in Venezuela. Just have a look at what's going on in Libya. The state has collapsed, actually. This is the result of irresponsible policy, which has a direct impact on global economy. So not only in energy, but also in policy, in political area, we have to establish a closer cooperation in order to avoid such disturbances. And talking about the increase, well, really, we have increased by 400,000 barrels, as we agreed with our partners. We can do 2,100 more.
Thursday, as you'll be aware, speaking at the United Nations, President Trump accused OPEC, of which Saudi Arabia is the de facto leader, of ripping off the rest of the world. He also this weekend called King Salman of Saudi Arabia and asked him to increase production. So how much oil is Saudi Arabia pumping right now, and how much oil is Saudi Arabia prepared to provide?
Well, thank you, Ryan, and let me express my pleasure to be here. This is my second year in a row to participate in this great forum. It's a distinct honor to be on the panel with Honorable President Putin and other colleagues. And of course, I have almost a weekly communication channel directly with His Excellency Alexander Novak, where we work together on our bilateral relationship, but also importantly on stabilizing the global market. I want to acknowledge the catalytic role that President Putin and the leadership of Saudi Arabia played in bringing the kind of stability that the President just talked about, in particular the meeting a couple of years ago on the sidelines of the G20 in Huangzhou, where the two leaders, President Putin and His Royal Highness Prince Mohammed bin Salman, agreed that we will bring producers of a like-minded, responsible position to bring stability back to the market. And I think our success speaks volumes for the alignment and the leadership of Russia and Saudi Arabia in global energy markets. As the President said, from the first conversation we had, our objective was to bring supply and demand in balance, inventories within a comfortable range, and investment flows back into the industry, and a revival of an industry that was suffering from bankruptcies, layoffs, and lack of direction. I think on all of those fronts, we have achieved 100% success. It remains the question of the price, and my position and the kingdom's position on the price is that it's left to the markets. What we can influence is fundamentals, and the fundamentals today are extremely healthy. Inventories are actually building counter-seasonally in the third quarter, usually the second half, as many of my colleagues in the energy industry knows that typically that's the high demand season, high refining, and we see a lot of draws on global inventories. We're seeing OECD and US inventories building since June, when we made the courageous decision in Vienna together, led by Russia and Saudi Arabia for the OPEC plus grouping, that it's time to ease supplies. I can tell you that at that time, or preceding our meetings in Vienna, Saudi production was below 10 million for the entire first 5 months of the year. In October, we're producing about 10.7 million, and I anticipate that November will be slightly higher. This is not a unilateral decision. We've made a commitment together with Russia and other partners that we will bring compliance back to 100%, and we're on our way to do this, and this has translated just between Russia and Saudi Arabia as of today to about 1 million barrels between the two countries, 700 plus 300. I know the UAE, Iraq, and we have the energy minister from Iraq here in the room has also pumped more. So the OPEC plus is very responsive to meeting demand. And I said just before the panel today that not a single customer of Saudi Aramco has requested a barrel since June that has not been responded to. But I think we have to assume that the forces that the Honorable President mentioned, geopolitical tension, speculation, will ultimately ebb, and we will see stability back in the market. I think what's important is to think what is going to happen in the next decade and beyond, as supply continues to decline in maturing fields, as demand continues to grow at a healthy pace. Is the energy industry prepared to invest? And thanks to the alignment that Russia, Saudi Arabia, OPEC, and other producers have, we can provide that assurance that the market will have stewardship and that there is predictability and stability.
Thank you very much, Patrick. For the last several months now, you've been talking about how the oil price is going to go to $100 a barrel. It's been growing quite quickly. Do you think it could go beyond $100 a barrel? Where are we headed?
I will not make an announcement today, you know, in front of Mr. President Putin and His Excellency Khaled Al-Faleh. I think fundamentals of the market is just that you have a strong demand in the market, but you have, it is true, some supply side disruption, which is not coming at all from the OPEC countries, which are playing their role to balance the market. And His Excellency is right to say that the inventories are building up. But you have other elements in the markets, which are more of the geopolitical side, which were mentioned by President Putin, which are also taken into account. And the market anticipates today more disruption on the supply side than required. And so this is why, you know, we have broken this type of ceilings. I don't of $80. We are going up quickly, and everything is possible. You know, what we have observed in the last two, 3 years is a huge volatility in the oil market, huge volatility. And we were at 42 1 year ago, 85 today, 100% in 12 months. So that's the situation. Again, it's not, as I said, as well, very good for the industry because, you know, at this level of price, some countries, emerging countries, have difficulty and the demand could be affected, which is, we don't need that to invest. We don't need that. And a company like Total, we worked hard to be able to live at $50 per barrel. So 60, 65 is enough to invest, in fact. And it's true that we have been prudent in the last years, but now we are investing more and more.
President Putin, is it right for the President of the United States to be so actively trying to manage the price of oil? We're coming up on elections in the United States. He's concerned about the price of gas. A gallon of gas in the United States costs almost $3. Traditionally, voters punish the party in power when prices rise ahead of elections. Is he doing the right thing, or actually should he step out of the oil market and let the market dictate what happens?
Well, I have already talked about it, and I'd like to repeat, we had a positive meeting with U.S. President in Helsinki. If we touched upon the topic that we're discussing now with him, I would say if you want to find the culprit of who's guilty that prices are growing, then you should just have a look in the mirror. You have just been talking about geopolitical factors of oil price increase. They are real. They play a real role at the market, and probably we'd better not intervene in those market process, and probably we shouldn't try to get some competitive advantages using political tools, and probably we should not try to regulate prices as the USSR did, because this is not for good. When we talk about our coordinated actions with OPEC, we actually do not employ unnecessary tools and instruments. What we do is we just put supply and demand in balance at the market, and that's it. And all the rest, as of today, are just pure geopolitical factors. As for gas prices, they are built out of oil prices, because prices for oil are built at the market and gas prices are oil dependent. There is a certain time lag of 5 to 6 months, and gas price will be fluctuating and it will be dependent on oil price. And what's going on in the United States? The United States is one of the chief producers of oil and gas in the world. And everything that relates to latest technologies that environmental experts are actually against. Sometimes this production is actually barbaric, and we try to escape such approaches. But I do not know if somebody is trying to influence the administration there. Well, let us just talk about energy. Please do not drag me into political processes and rumors of the United States. Otherwise, they will say that
you're
we interfere.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.